Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Michael, Mo, Tim, and the occasional guest discussing analytics issues of the day and periodically using explicit language while doing so. Find them on the web at analyticshour.io and on Twitter at analyticshour. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, Michael.
Do you feel the excitement building?
I was coming in a little hot.
No. We're about a month away from being back.
We'll be back.
It'll be better than ever. So, yeah, only 1 month left. A couple more rebroadcasts. So we'll get the whole team back together. Going to hit the ground running in July with some exciting new episodes and content. So I'm pretty excited. But we're here to talk about a rebroadcast that we did. This show was back in 2017. Our guest was Dr. Laraz Margalit, who at that time, she was with Clicktail. And I think she doesn't work there anymore. She's now like a chief behavioral researcher at,
Topics.
Anyways.
Maybe, yeah.
But Clicktail also has since been acquired by Content Square. So, you know, the world changes all 2017.
Clicktail doesn't even work at Clicktail anymore.
Exactly right. So. Exactly. Anyway, when I was going back and re-listening to this and just thinking about this episode, when I first discovered web analytics back in 2004 and just started trying to Google it and put my arms around what it was, I was sort of intrigued by basically the idea of like a group of people that I was trying to figure out what their intention was by what they did, and the sort of the social psychological aspects, or on the show you kind of mentioned, you know, behavioral economics, which is sort of like another side of that same coin, maybe, I don't know. But I was always fascinated by that. And so this show is really cool because we actually got to talk to a real psychologist about that topic. This one has always been a really fond one in my mind.
I don't remember how or where we found her, but she definitely was one of the, I mean, just utterly brilliant and delightful people to listen to. I'm not sure how much we've cherry picked our rebroadcast episodes for people who were like, that person was just passionate about their field and really fun to talk to, but she certainly was.
Well, and she knew her stuff, and I liked how practical and how thoughtful kind of the way that she was trying to help people think about what to do. And there's stuff that sort of like we know so much better today. Obviously this episode, Daniel Kahneman came up, and Michael Lewis book, I think it would just recently come out, The Unknowing Project.
The Undoing Project.
Yeah. I always get that wrong. I don't know why. I always pick one of the wrong words. Something. And then obviously Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, which I'm attempting to read this year in 2021. And you just pick it up, and every time you're just like, mind blown one more time. I don't know how to even put my arms around this, but like, that's what was so cool, is her stepping through kind of a lot of really cool concepts and ways to think about things and how to do that. It pays to have maybe a doctor of psychology on staff if you're going to be a fully featured analytics department, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. And teach them how to do tagging. Yeah.
Well, sure.
And make them wish they had never accepted that job.
I mean, that's the beauty of the emerging no-code, movement. You don't have to have any technical skills to be able to do any. Sorry, I can't even finish it with a straight face. All right. Any other thoughts, or should we just let people
listen? I think we should probably head on to the old show.
All right. Well, with all that said, we know what you're thinking. You want to get on with this show, so this is episode 65. Have you ever stopped for a second as you hovered over that order button? Does anyone care how you feel right now? You know, data collection in digital is ubiquitous. But what led you to this point? And how can what I know about you as a marketer help me influence others to take this same action?
Certainly, optimization of the existing data helps drive the cause forward, but while it may seem trite at this point, it also remains true. The behavioral data we collect about consumers gives a strong signal about what has happened, but leaves a lot of murkiness around why. And so on this episode, we should talk about that a little bit. So obviously, I'm joined by my co-host, Tim Wilson. Tim, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling fantastic.
Okay, well, let's analyze that statement just a little bit, because on this episode, we're talking about the psychology of digital analytics. And obviously, to help us avoid the Jungian slips or the Freudian archetypes or whatever, we've got some help. Dr. Liraz Margalit, she is a web psychologist, she's a keynote speaker, and she's the head of behavioral research at ClickTail. In her work there, she integrates cognitive and behavioral economic perspectives to analyze online consumer behavior and deliver actionable insights for stakeholders. She was awarded the Online Business Excellence Award for 2016, and her consumer behavior research was awarded with the Best of Neuromarketing 2016. Her research and studies can be found in top business magazines such as Entrepreneur, TechCrunch, and Forbes, and she also writes an ongoing column on the Psychology Today blog named Behind Online Behavior. Welcome to the show, Liraz.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So I think right out of the gate, the first thing our listeners are going to want to know is, what is Tim's deal? No, I'm just kidding.
No, that's the question for the end of the episode.
Or
the end of the session, then, I guess. Maybe that's what it is.
The end of the session, right, exactly. So let's lean back. No, but how did you get into this intersection of digital behaviors and psychology? And what has your work kind of led to, what led to that point?
Okay, so actually this is a very interesting, kind of a funny question, because when I came to ClickTail, they knew that they're looking for someone that will help them analyze the data, because at the end of the day, although this field belongs mostly to analysts and consultants, we are dealing with human behavior. If you think about it, all the interactions that we have, the clicks, the scrolling, this is a way to express what we think. This is a way to express different thought processes, if you scroll fast or if you scroll slow. So these are two different ways to express what you have in your mind. So then they were smart enough to think that, okay, in order to really understand and not just answering the what, in order to really understand the why behind the behavior, we need to have someone that has a clue about the why. And this is how I get into this spot, into this position.
So were you recruited? Was ClickTail or a previous, was somebody convincing you that this was a space you should hop into? Or was this something that you were looking at saying no one is actually doing this? Or maybe kind of the neuromarketing was already there. It seems like an area that is not talked about so often, and yet somehow you landed in it.
Yeah, so actually, to be honest with you, I don't know any other web psychologist in the same position, not in Israel where I'm based and not abroad. And the way I look at the position, this is kind of a research position, and my work at ClickTail actually incorporates two different parts. So first, our closely with our consultant and analyst try to provide answer to the question why. Why are visitors behave the way they do? What motivates their behavior? I try to uncover the decision-making processes, conscious and unconscious, because I truly believe that better understanding leads to better experience. And we all know that today, in today's business, we are not selling products nor services. At the end of the day, we are selling experiences. And the other part of my work is to work closely with our innovation team, data science team. So we have data scientists and behavioral engineers and behavioral analysts. And together, what we try to do is to take all the rich experience that ClickTail has gained over the years and to productize it. So if you think about it, our clients can have actionable behavioral insights in the website as if they have their own psychologist. So this is a research position integrated with a product, a way to think differently about the product.
So it's almost like you were, it was an economics, as you're talking, it's kind of the field of behavioral economics kind of crops up, where it's like economists used to think that everybody behaved rationally, and then they came along and said, oh wait, there are human beings involved. So that whole field, as it's exploded, it is kind of that complementary aspect of saying, we wish it was that clean. We wish we could just make the button larger, and because we've done that, it is more visible, and therefore people will click on it more often. And you're bringing, I hate to say the, it's not the softer side, it's just more the human psychology side. So
exactly. And if you think about it, today's businesses, every company that respects itself will have a data science or innovation team, whatever you like to call it. But I think the problem today with all these innovations is that they rely on the data to provide them with answers. And we have many, many types and sources of data, different sources of data. This is what we like to call big data today. So we have data that relates to the social media, like likes and shares and type of user, type of device, how many clicks. So we have tons of data today. But I think that if you're only going to pull linear regression, this is not going to provide you the insights that you're looking for. And I can give you a very simple example. So let's say that your data scientist discovered that all men coming from US tend to purchase more in the morning hours. So if this is actually what they discover, if this is the finding, so the recommendation will be to provide more promotions for men in the morning hours. But then if I add another piece of information to this story, and I'm going to tell you that I observed the store, and this is actually a brick and mortar store, and I can see that men tend to purchase more in the morning hour because there is a friendly and very attractive salesperson. And this is the confounding effect. So my recommendation will be completely different. I will recommend you to add another friendly, attractive salesperson in the afternoon. So this is why it's so important to understand the why and not only relying on the data to provide us with answers.
I feel like a lot of what you're saying right now sounds a lot like what I've been kind of lectured and learned over the years from the voice of customer, from the 4C or Opinion Lab, kind of saying the same thing, that you can measure behaviorally what people are doing, but if you're not asking them why they did it, is it sort of a cousin to that?
I think there is one major difference between the voice of customer and 4C and the research that I conduct here. And I think the difference is to relying on the text, meaning that I don't think that asking our customers how did they feel in a certain interaction, I don't believe in this idea, and I will explain why. So first, we know that it's not scalable. So you cannot ask each and every one of your customers, but let's just leave this reason aside. But there is more fundamental reasons. And one is that there is a big gap between what people will say and the real motivators behind people's behavior. And it's not that they lie to you. Of course they don't. It's that we just don't know. We don't have a clue. There are so many factors that influence our behavior. For example, we know that we are affected by environmental cues and by our emotions. Think about it. If you had a bad day, you will think differently about decisions that does not relate to the reason that you had a bad day, for example. And of course, we have cognitive biases. And We know that if we see an older guy, we'll think differently than we see a younger guy. If we see certain color, if we see red, we'll think different than if we see blue color. So there are so many factors that influence our behavior, and people are not aware of these factors. So I don't think, and we know that people are not aware for the reason and the motivators behind their behavior. So I don't like asking people for their motivators. I like to just observe their behavior. I think observing their behavior can give us the perfect answer. And there is one more reason, and that is that recently many studies that were conducted on this area found that most of our day-to-day interactions are based almost entirely on nonverbal signals, on nonverbal cue. It's not about what you say, it's about the way you say it. It's about your digital, it's about your body language, your facial expression, the distance that we have from one another. So let me give you an example, a quick example. So I can ask you guys if you like to have dinner with me today, tonight. And of course you will say yes, because you are being polite. But from the way you say it, I can infer that you actually mean that you don't like to have dinner with me. So it's not about what people say, it's about how they say it. So what I discovered in my studies of the online interaction is that the same way that in face-to-face interaction we have nonverbal signals, we have those nonverbal cues in the digital arena. And I think that if we'll be smart enough, we'll be able to capture those signals. So I mentioned if visitors scroll fast or if visitors scroll slow. So this make a difference. And if we're going to nail these differences, what I like to call digital body language, then we will be able to understand the visitor's mindset and how he actually feels without having to ask them.
So it's behavioral, but looking at behavioral with a more of a nuance from, instead of they did click, but how quickly did they click, or how quickly did they scroll, or where was the mouse hovering? Still, that's still inherently imperfect. Like in a perfect world, you're getting, it's so funny that one of the founding technology guy, I'm blanking, it was Steve something at Eloqua. I think he wrote a book called Digital Body Language.
Really?
But in his, that world was trying to say we need to go beyond, I'm trying to think what his, he was talking about lead scoring and B2B. So I think it was still much more mechanical of the specific actions, whereas you are really saying you want to be able to look at what can you do without looking at somebody's hands and face and expression, but their behavior with more subtlety. And you're still trying to look at it kind of in mass or aggregate. I mean, segmenting, yes, but you're still trying to use a proxy for what would, in a perfect world, you'd watch everybody and literally observe. You'd be tracking their face and every aspect of their body. Is that right?
We do in the face-to-face interaction. We have a special part in our brain that all its functionality is to infer what other people's feeling, about other people's emotion, actually. So this is what this part of the brain aim to do. And by the way, just an FYI, we know that today with all the screen time that kids are exposed to, there are problems for kids in the younger generation to actually detect facial expression. Because in order to develop this part of the brain, we need to be exposed to face-to-face interaction. So what I'm saying that this is a really major part of the way we understand other people. And we think that it's about what we say. But the most important part is how we say it. So I just say, okay, so you try to develop chatbots and you try to develop AIs, but you don't capture the one important thing, in that the mindset of the visitors. So just imagine that you are going to develop a chatbot that will guide you in a flower website. So you want to buy flowers to a funeral, and then he wishes you a fantastic day. So I think that this is something that is very wrong about how we try to develop chatbots. We try to base all our understanding, all our knowledge on the text, on how people and on what people say. And we should actually emphasize how they are saying it. And I can tell you that only with this type of information, with pieces of data of how people interact with each other, I can infer a lot about their actual mindset. So I can automatically detect their intent after a few seconds that they land on the page.
No, I think that's really good. And actually, one concept, Liraz, that you put into some of your writing is kind of this idea of a conversion cycle versus a conversion point. And so how do you suggest that marketers kind of start to configure or build that kind of concept into how they do measurement?
So first, we need to realize that conversion is not an action. This is not something we measure. So I have to tell you that when I was last week in the US, so we had different roundtables, and there is one question that I started with. And this is, what is your average conversion rate? And we know that typically for most clients, and I'm not only talking about retailers, we are talking about between 3 to 10%. And when I'm talking about conversion, conversion is defined as a prospect that completed the whole process from beginning to end, whatever this process may be. It doesn't have to be a transaction. You can define conversion however you wish to define it. So then I have another question. So if the average conversion rate is about 3%, what about the other 97%? Can we actually say something about their experience? Were they negative? Were they positive? Can you actually infer from this piece of data that 97% of the visitors that didn't convert had a negative experience? No, of course not. And the discussion about conversion is always yes and no, black and white, converted, didn't convert. And I really think that we have to think differently about conversion. And here is why. Let me share a personal story with you. So my husband wanted to buy me a gift for our 7 years anniversary. So he entered this really fancy jewelry website and he sees there this amazing watch. But the watch was extremely expensive. So he decided to wait until I come back home. And in the meantime, he left the website. Now, at the evening, I came back home and we both entered the website together. And I saw this watch that was truly an amazing watch. But then I told him, listen, tomorrow we are going to take the day off anyway to celebrate our anniversary. So why don't we go to the store together, to the mall, and purchase the watch there? So he agreed, of course, because he has to. And the next day, we went to the mall and we purchased the watch. So if you think about it, what do we have here? We have two perfectly successful interactions. But if we are to measure those interactions using the old classic conversion rate, we will analyze or classify those interactions as negative only because the visitors didn't convert online. So we know that sometimes it takes a few iterations for the visitor to convert. And sometimes the visitor starts its journey on the website and completes his journey or his transaction on the brick and mortar store. So we really have to start thinking about conversion cycles and not about conversion rate.
And in your work, I mean, are you working with people to actually break that down? Because obviously the concept, I think, is really great. The technology is a little bit problematic still in terms of actually allowing that kind of measurement to happen. Is that some of the stuff that you're working with or doing today?
Exactly. This is what I'm working on right now, because you know what's the problem? The problem is that we always talk about experiences. Think about it. We talk about user experience and customer experience, and we already defined the era of experiences. But did you ever stop to think what is an experience? What is the definition of an experience? So in order to actually measure and evaluate experience, we have to think about the definition of an experience. And we know that the formal definition of an experience from a psychological perspective is the interaction between a subject and a stimulus that is influenced by a personal interpretation. So it's not about the visitor or the customer, and it's not about the layout or the design. It's about what happens in the interaction between the two. It's about what the person brings to the situation with him, his personal background, his set of expectations, his current mindset, his personality trait. And that's why two people can interact with the same stimulus and they can have two completely different stories to tell about their experiences. So, for example, two people can go to the exact same party, and for one person, he can describe the experience as fun and enjoyable, and for the other person, the room was too smoky, too noisy, he didn't like the people, and the food was bad. So two people can interact with the exact same stimulus, and they can have two completely different stories to tell about their experience. And the same goes for the online experience, for the online interaction. Two people can interact with the exact same site, and they can have two completely different stories to tell. So this is one aspect that we need to measure. And there is another aspect that is even more important. And that is that one single experience is made up of many, many smaller experiences. So take a visit to Disneyland, for example. So we can go to Disneyland, we can go on a roller coaster, we can stand online, we can shake hands with Mickey Mouse, we can visit the Disney store. So one single experience is made up of many, many smaller experiences. And we cannot possibly remember all the experiences because we don't have enough capacity in our brain. Think about it, in one day, even in 1 hour, we have so many experiences. So there was an evolutionary mechanism that was developed that his functionality is to compress the whole experience to one general feeling of how he felt about the experience. So after a while, if you are to be asked about your experiences, you are going to say, we had a nice experience, we had a wonderful, you're not going to remember it all. So what I'm doing now in my work is to find a way to differentiate the different experiences. So I discovered that every page triggered different type of experience for different type of people. So as I mentioned previously, if I'm able to automatically detect the visitor's intent, so I can also understand if the interaction was positive or was it negative, and I'm able to come up with an experience score that can measure how visitors felt about the experience. But even more important, it doesn't matter what happened in every single moment. What matters is the remembered value. What matters is what you are going to remember from an experience. And there is an example that I really like to use, that Kahneman, he's an Israeli-American psychologist, and he once told this example. He was telling about a man listening to a symphony, and he really enjoyed himself. And he has been listening to the symphony for 20 minutes. And at the end of the symphony, there was an awful scratching sound. And this man described this as it ruined his whole experience. But he had had the experience. And still, it doesn't matter. What matters is what left, what carried over after the experience already ended. So we need to take all these pieces of information, all this knowledge that we have, to the interaction with the website.
So back to earlier, it does seem like that's the sort of thing that you would want to say towards the end of the experience. I totally get that if you ask people, you know, what's your purchase intent? Asking them to predict what they're doing in the future is maybe, or might do in the future, would be unreliable. But would it still be unreliable to say, how was your experience today, to get that sort of level, to be able to then go back and segment that other data that you have to try to figure out what looked like, what was the equivalent of that scratching sound for this group that reported they didn't have a good experience? And I guess that still doesn't factor in why they were coming or what their emotional state was when they arrived? Or is that not, it seems so tough to get to that good or bad experience based on just observed behavioral data. I'm still struggling there.
Yeah, I can see what you say. So my answer has two parts. So first, I don't think that we can actually ask people how you felt just because they don't know. This evolutionary mechanism, the remembering self, it takes time to the remembering self to figure out and to consolidate the memory. So it's useless to ask people. So this is one part.
It's useless to ask them right in the moment, but in theory, if you could ask them 2 days or a week later, how was that experience? I mean, I definitely recognize that in myself. We had a vacation. What we're saying the day we get back may be directionally where we wind up, but it's really 6 months later, you know, how was that trip or how was that experience? Is that's where you're saying that evolutionary mechanism has kind of consolidated it?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Is that part of it?
Okay. Yeah. Got it. Because we have two different selves. We have the experiencing self and we have the remembering self. And the experiencing self is the part of the brain that can answer the question, how do you feel right now? Are you happy right now? And there is the remembering self, and it can answer the question, are you happy with your life? Are you satisfied with your life? This is the part of the brain that keeps scores and documents the story of our life, exactly as you said.
Okay. And I cut you off. There was a second, you had a second more important point that I interrupted.
Yeah. So the more important point that I know that it sounds very difficult, but let me describe you something. So let's say that you see someone scrolling up and down. You can see many direction changes and you can see very few stops. So you can actually understand that there is a visitor, for example, that is highly motivated to find something, but he just can't find it. So this is one of the mindset, one of the behavioral pattern that they call the disorientation or the confusion. And in order to validate it, I took this recording or session replay because I track the mouse move of the visitors or the in-touch enabled device, the scroll. And then I take this recording and I ask different people to tag this recording, to tell me what they think. And they are not a psychologist. They're just regular people, regular students. And it turns out that different people, and we are talking about hundreds of people, will have the same interpretation of this specific recording. So this means that we can actually build different algorithms that will capture the intent of the visitors. So this is exactly what we did. So we observed many, many visitors' interactions across different industries, across different verticals, different devices. And we find out that there are 5 behavioral patterns that repeat themselves over and over again. And then we figured those behavioral patterns, those are the user's way to communicate their intent with us. This is what we like to call the digital body language of our visitors. And then we have developed 5 different algorithms, 5 different models for each behavioral pattern. And in order to validate those models, we took these algorithms and we ran them on thousands of entirely new interactions. And then we found that we can automatically understand and discover the visitor's intent in an accuracy level of 85%. So this is possible.
That's okay. That's cool. That's and so where you were starting was, if it's kind of like sentiment analysis, when one of the ways they'll test it is say, let me give, you know, 100, let 100 people read this tweet and see how many of them agree that this tweet is negative or positive. And then if you can, you match that up to the machine sentiment analysis and say, look, if this many humans, just like if you, I guess it's the same as if you show them just static pictures of people's faces and say, is this person angry, sad? And then if you can get to where the machine is smart enough. So it is, it's starting, the light bulb's starting to come on for me that it's a much more nuanced version As you're talking about scrolling and how often we get the request to say, oh, can we measure scroll depth? But it's literally a check mark of where we're going to capture in Google Analytics or Adobe Analytics that what percentage of the users got to the 80% spot on the page. The problem is what that's totally missing is did they get there because they couldn't find anything and they're scrolling, they scrolled back up because they scrolled to the bottom and they weren't finding what they looked for. And then they scrolled back up. And somebody got there because they were totally engaged and they were like, this is awesome and amazing, exactly what I'm looking for. Somebody else hit that same micro conversion because they couldn't find what they were looking for at all. And they wound up being incredibly annoyed. And if I was just watching those two people who both hit that little threshold, I'd say, oh yeah, clearly this person is annoyed and it's a mess. And this other person looks like they're like totally deliberately scrolling down and consuming the content.
Exactly.
I think
this is exactly my point. And, you know, I'm really happy that you said it because there is a tendency of analysts today to analyze behavior in isolation, meaning that they try to correlate different metrics with conversion. Just to give you an example, they can say higher click-through rate in a certain area correlates highly or positively or negatively with conversion. And I think that this is a wrong attitude, a wrong approach to analyze interaction, because behavior cannot be analyzed in isolation. As we say, we need to add the attribute and we need to add the following action. And a quick example, let's imagine that we are browsing in Amazon in our smartphone, and then we detect scroll followed by another scroll, or the exact same scroll followed by a click. So in the first example, the visitor just kept on scrolling because there was no interest in the content. But in the second example, there was an interest because after the visitor scrolled, he clicked on something. So it's all about analyzing the whole behavior, as a whole, and not relying on different metrics, because metrics are not a behavior. Human behavior or cognitive processes are much more complicated than to be analyzed in metrics.
One question I had was, to what extent does there need to be aspects of that individual's behavior that is known about that person? So things like who they are, you know, because so much of digital is anonymous.
Right.
Do we need to understand like things like, is it a man? Is it a woman? Is it someone who is wealthy? Is it someone who is uneducated? You know, are those attributes things that are necessary for us to make appropriate conclusions about someone's motivations at that point in time?
So I like to differentiate between demographics that were found to have very little correlation to conversion, and between personality traits. So what we talked about first, the mindset, if a visitor is goal-oriented, if he's a browser, these are mindset. These are a state of mind that can change from hour to hour. But there is another factor that is extremely important here, and this is the personality traits. So actually, I developed a model for personalization that is called the online behavior model, and it integrates between the three different elements, between the context of which a decision was made, and in the digital platform is the type of visitor, the type of website, type of industry, and there is the mindset, if a visitor is goal-oriented, if he just came to browse, and there is the personality traits. And there were two personality traits found to greatly affect visitors' purchase decision-making. And these personality traits are the maximizer versus the satisfizer. When I'm talking about the maximizer, for example, if a visitor has a list of options, so the maximizer will go through, search through all the list, one option, one by one, and conduct a cost-benefit calculation. And he couldn't decide until searching through all the different options. And even after he's going to decide, he's still never satisfied with his decision. And he keeps thinking that maybe there is another option better for him somewhere. And if you think about it, you can actually detect these personality traits if you detect visitors' interaction. And there is the satisfier. And the satisfier is the person I like to call the good enough. Because if he has a list of options, he is going to choose the first option that meets his criteria, and he is going to feel good about this option and about himself. And these are the people in general that happily live their life without being bothered about the fact that there might be a better option for them somewhere.
There's not the third option that is the 7-year anniversary trying to get my wife something appropriate watch. That's not a third type. So just to this all makes a ton of sense from a coloring and informing. I'm just trying to think through what the pure data scientist or the somebody focused on kind of reinforcement learning could say, and I don't know what the response is. You know, all that stuff doesn't matter if we've got the machine pointed at just the behavior and we can figure out there's reinforcement learning or deep learning or something going on where we're swapping stuff out just to figure out what works better, then it doesn't really matter why. And a part of it feels like, well, you may not get to that point. Like, it would be way more helpful to actually have an understanding of the why to kind of guide that learning. Because what you're talking about does have very much a heavy analytical component. When you talk about these are these five models and we were able to build the machine to kind of recognize and identify these patterns, that was informed starting from everything we've been talking about. I just wonder, will there be, you know, listeners or other people in the industry who would say, you know what, all that doesn't matter. Just keep changing stuff and figure out what works. And we don't need to know about why. Like, I feel like I've heard those cases made, not necessarily as a counter. And is that horribly flawed in some way that you can put your finger on?
Yeah. So I used to hear that a lot, actually. And I think that today, if we are going to focus on personalization, for example, and about what and about the data science development in this specific area, because this is the holy grail, how to personalize the experience in order to actually adapt different type of experiences to different type of visitors, right? So today we have two main approaches for personalization that those different approaches are driven on data. So the approaches are the user-user approach and the item-item approach. So very quickly, when we are talking about the user-user approach, this algorithm tries to find similarities based on visitors' preferences. So if, for example, I ordered the movie Dirty Dancing and the movie Pretty Woman, and there is another user that ordered the exact same movies, so if the next movie that I'm going to order is going to be Ghost, this algorithm is going to offer the movie Ghost to the other visitor. He tries to understand the visitor's preferences. And there is another approach that is the item-item approach. So this algorithm tries to find similarities in different product characteristics. So if I ordered a melon and an orange, so this algorithm thinks to itself, okay, they're pretty much at the same price, they're both tasty, and they're both single served, so the next item that I'm going to offer her is going to be an orange, for example. So those algorithms are partly successful, okay? So they were able to make some changes in the conversion rate, but the change is very, very limited. And the problem of these algorithms is that they are based on a wrong assumption. And the assumption is that our past purchases, our past behavior can predict our future behavior. And as a psychologist, I can safely assure you that this assumption is wrong, because in order to really understand and predict visitors' behavior, there are different elements that we have to take into consideration. And one very important element is the context of which a decision was made. So, for example, I'm not going to behave in a party the same way that I'm going to behave in my workplace. Different contexts equal different behaviors. And another thing is the visitor's mindset that we already discussed. So that's why if you are going to ignore all these psychological factors, you are going to make some changes in the conversion, but only to a certain point.
So you'll be optimizing within an unfortunately narrow and possibly slightly flawed. You may get to say, oh, we've reached optimal because we've watched our whatever this thing is get better, slow down, get better. Now we've achieved the state, and now we're gonna kind of. I guess it sounds like the risk is that you wind up perceiving your maximum success of the experience you're delivering being a lower point than it could be.
Exactly.
If you factored in the, got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this is really good. One of the things I love to try to do is try to bring it back to where can people do some things tactically? How do they get started down this path? And what are the first few things you would recommend that they start to try to do to kind of move toward a model that's kind of more encompassing of thinking about the person's experience as opposed to the point of conversion?
Okay, so first, I would suggest to analysts to start thinking like a psychologist and to doubt everything, meaning that very quickly we found out that people usually, and you started with this team, people are not rational. Human beings are not rational. So we need to understand what type of factors involved in their decision-making processes. And we know that if you are talking about purchase decision-making are found to be based on emotions. It's how the product makes you feel and not if you really need it. So there is two-level mechanism. So the first thing is that your limbic system decides that it wants this specific product. And the second thing is that there is a rational mechanism that start making excuses why do we actually need to purchase this product. And there are two different things. So when we optimize the experience, we need to think about how people are going to feel about our product, how people are going to feel about the layout, about the design, and then if we are going to actually try to fit the way their decision-making process works, we then need to provide them with ways to rationalize their decisions, their ideas. So we need to have emotional content and rational content, and we have to keep thinking like psychologists, asking the why behind the behavior and not settle for only the what.
So on that front, is there a variation of how much the degree that the emotional and feeling side comes in when comparing types of industry? You know, I could see, you know, buying a luxury watch or apparel or retail consumer stuff all the way to maybe a very considered purchase, B2B mechanical. Are there cases where there is much less potential? I'm thinking about some past companies I've worked for as well as some current clients where it is a much more, I need a product to fulfill a need. And is there a level where that plays in less? I could see there's no place that the experience and the mindset and the emotion and the feelings don't matter at all, but does it vary in degrees as to how much based on the industry and the type of product and the target customer?
Of course. So of course, when we are talking about insurance or financial products, of course, we are applying more rational cognitive process, but we have to understand that there are different types of products, and there are nice to have products and there are functional products. So when I'm talking about nice to have products, so for example, if I have a closet full of dresses, I don't really need another dress. I will purchase it because of how it makes me feel when I picture myself wearing it. But when I'm talking about functional products, we purchase them only because of their function. They don't make us feel anything like light bulb or USB or different type of connections. So we really have to understand the type of products we try to cater. And another thing is that if we really understand that we have different types of people, so we really have to stop use the concept best practices, because if we think about it, what are best practices? Best practices actually means that there is a common denominator that can be applied to different types of people. But we try to actually think differently about people. And personalization actually is the realization that we have different types of people, so we need to provide them different type of experiences. So if we actually agree on this, and I think we all can agree on what is personalization and why we really need to be in that place, we really have to stop use the term best practices, and we have to understand the type of our audience, and for different type of audience, we like to provide different type of experiences. And another thing is that different type of people will differ in how they treat different type of products. So for example, for me, I can think of computers as a functional product, and you can think of something to wear as a functional product. So we really need to understand how different visitors interact with different products.
Oh, that's really good. I like that statement about best practices as well. It's all too often people tend to try to shoot down the middle, and they leave a lot of good things out because of that. But one of the best practices that we have here on the show is to go around and do a last call where we talk about things that we found in the last couple of weeks that we think are interesting. And this has been a really great conversation, Dr. Margalit, and thank you so much for that. But why don't we kick off the last calls? Do you have a last call that you want to share?
Sure. So actually, if there is one book that I really enjoyed and I think that can be really relevant to all the people that actually want to better understand the psychology and the decision-making processes, is How We Decide by Juna Lehrer. And I highly recommend this book. And I think there were different negative things that people actually said about this book, that there are some inaccuracies there. But I think in general, if you read this book thoroughly, it can change your perspective about how we make decisions.
Oh, nice. That's so Jonah Lehrer, who had a little bit of a... So that you're saying it's good content, even though, I mean, he got kind of in all sorts of hot water based on his poor behavior from a journalist perspective, right?
Yeah, I know. But you know how people, they try to, like, they generalize the whole book because, yeah, I agree. What he did was very bad. But you can find very good content there. I don't think that...
No, if it's good content. And I actually remember hearing him or reading him something kind of as he reflected on what had happened. Because I think he wound up being... Yeah, it was tough. He was young to have his industry kind of... Or his career kind of trashed. But How We Decide. I almost was going to ask, is there a good book somebody could read? Because all I could think about is like the Predictably Irrational, which is more the... behavioral economics side of it. The How We Decide sounds like an awesome awesome way to kind of think a little bit different about this whole area.
Right. And also Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman.
Oh, thank you.
Oh yeah, that's on my list.
Right.
Which actually brings up my last call, which is a book I just finished recently called The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, which actually talks a lot about the life of Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman and their work. Also, a couple of Israeli psychologists. So that book is really interesting because obviously it walks through a lot of what they came up with, but it also goes into a lot of depth about their relationship and collaboration over the years, which is really profound. So anyways, really enjoyable book, somewhat tangential to what we just discussed, but still very interesting. And so if you're interested in that, that is definitely a great book to read because basically the founding fathers of behavioral economics and the work that they did in the 70s around sort of proving that we are not rational in our decision making. So anyways, really good stuff. Anyways, Tim, what about you?
And they were two very, very different personalities, right?
Who worked very well together. Extremely different. Yeah. Very different from each other.
Oh my God. I really need to finish my last reading assignment so I can move on to this other stuff.
I know, right?
Well, so just in case people are saying, no, I don't want to read six books. I'd rather take a course. My last call, which maybe is a little ironic, or is I've came across a post on Medium that's called "Every Single Machine Learning Course on the Internet Ranked by Reviews." And it just kind of, it's a long post, but it's, as I've sort of keep thinking, I need to sort of it just understand what this whole machine learning world is. It's kind of nice because it actually has a pretty good little write-up of, you know, what's the approach? Is this coming at it from, oh, this covers analytics and machine learning? Of course, I'm like, I don't fully understand the difference between the two. They even talk about what tools are used in the course. So I'm not claiming that I am going to sign up and take one of those, especially now that I have 4 books that I need to read that are not down that path. But it's a good post for people who are maybe looking to dive into some open courseware on that topic.
No, that's great. And thank you for that. And again, this is a really interesting conversation because so much of what we do in digital analytics, we often describe as art and science. But actually, there's science to apply to what we would call sometimes the art, which is knowing who the customer is and applying good thinking to them. So thank you very much, Dr. Margalit. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. As you've been listening to the show today, and if you've heard things that you are interested in learning more about or would like to ask questions, please don't hesitate to get to us on our Facebook page or Twitter account or on the Measure Slack. And we would love to hear from you. We'd love to gather your questions. And I'm sure, Liraz, you probably would love to hear from folks too if they have questions about any of this.
Of course.
So, you know, I don't know if you're on the Measure Slack at all, but we highly recommend it as a place to understand the psychology of analysts. but anyway, it's been great having you on. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah. And for my co-host, Tim Wilson, remember, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Twitter or in the Measure Slack. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io or on Twitter at analyticshour.